Roger and Barton gave what Gisho calls way-seeking mind talks. They talked about sort of general contours of their life that they felt like, and any experiences they had that they felt like led them up to the point of where they jumped into Zen practice, and what sort of keeps them going with that. And that is, in general, what is known as a way-seeking mind talk. It's often the very first talk a student ever gives in a Zen center. The teacher taps them one day and says, "It's time for you to give a talk." And so you can just talk about your life, you know, about how you got here. It's a kind way to break in. But it's also, it turns out that this is one of the most important questions that somebody can ask you, and in asking you, force you to sit down and look at what is it that brought you to your Zen practice, and why do you maintain it? Why do you continue? You know, a lot of people come, they come a few times and then leave. But when someone really gets very serious about it, there's something operating there, and you really need to know what that is. That is what we call the way-seeking mind. And we not only need to hear that voice once and go, "Oh, yeah, that's what I need to do." We need to hear it repeatedly, or else we tend to wander away from our practice. Now, when reading, you're reading Buddhist literature, you run into this subject frequently, but there's sometimes it's very confusing to you, because the word in Sanskrit, bodhicitta, is often translated in very different ways. Now, bodhicitta itself, literally translated, would be enlightenment or awakened mind. And the way you usually see it translated is as the mind of enlightenment. But the translation I like best is the one that Gisho has been using here. That's the one I first heard when I first started practicing way back in the 60s. Suzuki Roshi used it frequently. And that is the way-seeking mind. And I like that one best because I think it's the best translation of what is actually behind that phrase, bodhicitta. It catches sort of the essential aspect of this idea what does it sound like to you, way-seeking mind, of something that kind of calls you to practice, something that causes you to want to sit down and meditate and practice. And we can say it's what creates in us the aspiration to practice. I mean, all the millions of things out there that we could do that could catch our attention, which could even say, "I'm going to devote my life to that." What is it specifically that caused you to go this direction? Well, that's the way-seeking mind. Now, usually we see the word in a bigger phrase, used in a bigger phrase, or the translation of the way-seeking mind, and that is arousing the way-seeking mind. And that suggests that this is not a passive matter, that it sort of emphasizes the fact that this is not just a fancy name for enlightenment, but it's a crucial element in our aspiration to practice and to realize our enlightened true nature, our Buddha nature, our Bodhi mind, our enlightened mind, which is there already. This is not something out there that we have to go and get or chase after. It's right here, right now. And that raises a big question. So arousing this way-seeking mind is at the very heart of Zen practice. When you sit on your cushion, that's what you're doing moment after moment. You're touching that way-seeking mind. And without it, there is no practice. You wouldn't be here for 5 minutes. And on the other hand, we can say, without practice, way-seeking mind is something that does strike us once in a while, but very rarely. And when I was talking to my own sitting group, I used an ancient Buddhist analogy. It's said that there's a blind turtle living at the bottom of the sea, and that once every 100 years it rises to the surface. And in this instance, it rises to the surface, and it just happens there's a plank floating there with a knot hole in it, and it just happens his head goes out into the open air. That kind of a thing is the rarity with which most of us in our lives experience way-seeking mind, unless we have a practice that feeds it. Now, arousing the way-seeking mind, that sounds sort of rousing, you know, get on your motorcycle and go for it, which is a kind of attitude that some Rinzai students have, but that's not how we see it. It doesn't mean taking off full throttle, I'm going to get enlightened or bust. Because like I said, for one thing, there ain't no such thing really as getting enlightened. Enlightened mind is already here right now. What you have to do is wake up to it. That's something completely different than steaming off out there trying to get a hold of something. Dogen said that this is the mind of the whole earth. It is mind wood and mind stone. One of his beautiful poetic sayings. Well, if that's so, if it's the whole earth, why do we need to arouse it? If it's there with every step we take in our life, why aren't we experiencing it constantly? Well, it's very simple. You know, our consciousness, given the way we normally lead our lives, you could almost say is in a dazed condition. Everything that catches our attention and demands our further attention, everything is pulling us out of our calm, sane Buddha nature into some involvement that demands that we give credence and reality to everything we come into contact with. We hear the cash register ring and, you know, oh, there's money, and we go for it, this food, whatever it is. We are convinced that there's a world out there of things, ideas, even wonderful things like good causes, and that they have a kind of reality that demands our, well, for better word for it, our allegiance to them. In doing that, at the same time, of course, we then look inward and say, and there is a real me here who really needs the real that out there. Well, in all of this rat race, we become very dazed, I like the word, confused, dazed, deluded is the usual word. And In all this confusion, we no longer hear the voice-seeking mind. I use the word hear. I think of it as a voice. Don't make the mistake of reifying it. It's not a voice. But we can speak in that way because we have to find words to speak about this. But remember, it's not a real voice. It's not something that you literally hear with your ear. You hear it with your heart. But regardless of how confused we get in our life, the way-seeking mind is always there. But when we try to find that voice out there, we set ourselves up for suffering, because then this becomes one more thing that we're pursuing, that we're going after out there. And this is the source, this constant seeking for the answers to our problems and the gratification of our needs out there is the primary cause of our suffering. What is called for is for our just to be present, just here, right now, present to life. And it's there that our restless seeking ends, and we realize there's something else that I can affirm. I can affirm this life without any attachments to it. I can just affirm life. Now, as I was sort of pointing out a few minutes ago, the constraints of language and the need to try to express these inexpressible ideas means that we have to find some kind of point of view to speak to it with. It's very necessary when you hear me do this, and you always will, because that's the only way we can speak of it, that you remember that the way-seeking mind actually has no voice. It has no horizons. It has no depth and shallowness. It's boundless and timeless. And this wisdom has nothing to do with anything we can hold on to, yet there is nothing apart from it. It's just a featureless awareness, and yet it's the core of our life. It's what we call in Zen intimacy. And intimacy in Zen doesn't mean that close, it means no, nothing apart. We are all a part of one whole. And it is this that is speaking, quote, to us. Now, we've all awakened for brief moments from time to time, under circumstances, sometimes in emergencies, sometimes under great stress, sometimes when just sitting down quietly, hearing a bird or something. In Rinzai they make a great deal of this. They call these little kensho's or little enlightenment experiences. Now, I think that's looking at it in all the wrong way. They're just moments of being awake, of hearing the way-seeking mind saying, this is reality. This is the reality of my life. Not this craziness of my usual running around, trying to control everything and control who I am and what they are and freeze it down and get a hold of it, but of just letting go, and there it is. And like I say, we've all had these moments, sometimes really sort of stunningly, but we never knew what to do with it. Where do you go from there? What do I do? Well, you know, what I always say is, well, I had no idea at all until the day I found Zen. And then, wham, all of a sudden, oh, this is the way. That's why it's called the way. Ah, that's the way. That's the way to hear this voice and make it real in my life, realize it in my life. And of course, the way what the Zen teacher always tells you, well, sit down. He said, just shut up about that. That happened. Now just shut up. Now just sit down. Be quiet. Get your posture perfect so that you're really stable. Let your mind do what it's going to do. Just don't pay much attention to it. You'll get the message. And just be present to life. And I don't say your life, just be present to life. We're caught up too much in my life, your life, just life. And when you hear this voice clearly and you hear the Buddhist message, what the Buddha said, because this is what happened with him when he sat under the tree, then perhaps you will find your way. So that's what we mean by way-seeking mind. Now, I'm not giving. Jisho said I'm going to be having people giving from time to time these way-seeking mind talks. And I'm not giving one of those. So I said, well, okay, well, I'll talk about what does that mean so that people have some idea about what they're hearing when they hear these talks. But I thought to end this talk, while I was working on this talk, actually I first began talking about this subject with my own sitting group, and while I was sitting at my computer working on the talk, all of a sudden, in vivid detail, an incident in my young life came back. So I just wrote it down, so you're going to hear that little story.
Oh, no.
Whether you want it or not. It's not, there's nothing obscene in it, it's all a dream. And I should tell you that this is written as if I were still that young man. I had, from the time I was 16 until I think I was about 22 when this event occurred, I was in academia up to my neck, and I was being trained to become part of the academic world. And my last year I was there, I had a teaching fellow. And that meant suddenly I was dealing with the political side of a university. And if any of you know what I'm talking about, that's the dirtiest politics on earth. And the littlest and the meanest. And there was this one professor that he was head of the department, and he was sort of I adored him. He had been my Cub Scout master when I was a kid and had taught me to love birds. He was just this wonderful, sweet man, and he loved Jane Austen. Well, the 18th century was out in those days. Unless you were in Elizabethan, I'm giving you a big background on this because it's kind of fun. Unless you were in Elizabethan literature, you were just nowhere. So this guy was much too nice and much too gentle, and a cabal within the department formed and went after him. And I watched this thing, and I said, I got to get out of here. I don't want to be here anymore. But what was it going to do? It was as if my whole training had been pointed in one direction, and now I said, no, I don't want to go there. And also, this was right in the middle of the Korean War, and if you didn't go to the university, you went to Korea. So I had a problem. So summer vacation came on, and this is what happened. I have impulsively and almost without money hitchhiked to the Mexican border. The Rio Grande is flooding, but I climb over the temporary barriers and run across the bridge. The border guards allow me to enter Mexico, and I join a crowd of people trying to get on a bus for Mexico City. The whole city was filling up with water, and everybody was desperately trying to get out. So the next day, after having stood up the whole way, held up by the packed passengers, that was a day and a half, dazed but relentless, I take a jitney up into the mountains above Mexico City and arrive in the central square of Cuernavaca. It is early in the 1950s, and Mexico is still an almost alien place to a Midwestern American young man. But everyone is so helpful and kindly that I have soon been directed to an old-fashioned posada, or inn, whose owners take me in and make me part of their family. The decisions I must make about the direction of my life no longer worry me. They can wait while I steep myself in this unknown way of life. Each morning I walk to the sunny side of the Zocalo at an outdoor cafe where all the expatriates meet to gossip. Cuernavaca is sometimes called a sunny place for shady people. Members of the Hollywood 10, if you are old enough to know who they were, alcoholic writers running away from their lives, Europeans, some with titles, who rumor hints were collaborators with the Nazi occupation forces, divorcees living on limited marital settlements. These sophisticates fascinated me, but they could not answer the pressing questions that nagged at me. They seemed to be satisfied to slide painlessly into oblivion. Oh, it was a sea of alcohol, is what it was. It wasn't oblivion, it was alcohol. On the opposite side of the Zocalo from the alleyway where I am living is a cantina that Señor Edmundo has warned me about, because some of the men going out there are very, very bad men. They are part of the notorious underworld of the state of Morelos, famous for producing political assassins who hide out in the little Aztec Indian villages protected by the inhabitants who still idolize Zapata and the heroes of the Mexican Revolution. Each evening I join a parade of people strolling around the Zocalo in what is called the paseo, the traditional flirtation of the young and greeting of friends and strangers alike. When I pass the cantina, I hesitate, trying to work up the courage to go in and see for myself just what is going on in there. Finally, I break away from the paseo and walk into the forbidden place. But it is not in any way frightening. All the patrons are convivial and good-natured, welcoming and insisting I join them. The tequila begins to flow, and we are soon the greatest friends. When I leave to stagger back to the posada, they embrace me and insist I return soon. They promise to take me to an Aztec village high up in the mountains where I can experience the life of the Indians rather than the life of the mestizos. That is exactly what I am looking for, and I know I'll take them up on their offer. In the morning, while we are eating breakfast in the courtyard, a big American car pulls up at the front gate of the posada, and one of my new friends from last night comes to our table. Señor Edmundo and his wife and her duenna are suddenly coldly silent, as if an evil wind had blown through the gateway and frozen their tongues. Carlos ignores the absence of a greeting and invites me to go with him and his friends in the afternoon up into the mountains to the village they had described to me. Without a second thought, I said yes, I would meet them in the Zocalo after lunch. When Carlos left, the frigid silence continued at the table, but at last Señor Edmundo thawed, and he begged me as his friend and as one he felt responsible for not to go with the bad men up into the mountains. I tried to assure him that these men were treating me very well and nothing unpleasant would come of the trip. He shook his head in resignation, but the expression on his face said, "Crazy American." The big Buick raced up the dangerous twisting roads, through a beautiful mountain landscape where tiny villages clung to steep slopes with corn plots where the Indians grew their meager crops. There were four of us in the car, laughing and joking, but there was no alcohol and none of the devil weed I had been warned about. The village was a large one and in a spectacular setting. High cliffs rose abruptly above the valley, and on top of the cliffs were the ruins of an ancient Aztec pyramid. A stream cut through the middle of the town, and in it the Indian women were washing clothes, pounding them on the rocks and chattering like birds in the Nahuatl tongue. We left the car next to the simple and yet ornate church and walked down the main street. Everyone we met greeted us warmly, and some of them invited us into their houses. The men I was with were obviously well thought of here, and may well have been originally from this village. Though I knew almost no Spanish, one of the men, Carlos, knew very good English, having learned it when he lived for a few years in Los Angeles. We were soon all laughing and having a great time, but still no alcohol had appeared. It is as if we were visiting our family and needed to watch our manners. At one house, we were greeted by a young woman who was persuaded to unpack and show us the chinelo costumes that are worn during the festivities at Easter. We all got into the costumes and masks, and she showed us how to do the ancient dance that mimicked the defeat of the Moors by the Spanish in a world these Indians could only imagine. As we wandered down the one dirt road, we heard loud shouts and pistol shots nearby. A snarling dog ran out of an alleyway, a pack of men and boys in hot pursuit, brandishing their pistols and firing randomly. "Mad dog," yelled the English-speaking man, and he grabbed me and pulled me out of the way of the dog and the pursuers. We waited until the crowd had disappeared somewhere ahead and then resumed our evening stroll. The excitement of the day was over. Peace descended from the mountains above us like a benediction from the Aztec gods. When I mentioned that we had eaten nothing and it was getting late, the men talked among themselves and reported to me that there was no such thing as a cafe here, but that there was one old woman who kept a cauldron of pork and beans heated over her fire for just such occasions. Behind a high mud wall, a hag, dressed all in black, motioned us to come in, and she sat us down at a rickety table made of scrap wood. She stirred the big iron cauldron, and from it ladled its contents into cracked dime store bowls. The bowl of beans and a big spoon, nothing more. I stirred the beans and pulled out a piece of pork. It had bristles on one side of it. I hesitated a moment and then ate it with the same gusto my guides were eating from their bowls. With no light but that from the fire under the cauldron, we dropped some pesos on the table, thanked the old lady who had not said a word, and walked out into the night. We half sat, half reclined on the porch of the church. There was no man-made light anywhere, only the intense brilliance of the stars and the slender crescent moon above the mountain. Someone passed me a serape, and I curled up and fell asleep, listening to the soft sounds of the men talking together. I awoke in the pale light of the pre-dawn, while those around me were still sleeping. A mist rose from the river and shimmered against the cliffs, where it mingled with the smoke coming from the comal fires in each little house. Out of the silence, gently, prayerfully, the sound of the women's hands patting the tortillas to throw them on the comal for breakfast rose to the vast sky above. My mind grew silent, and my heart opened out and flew into the vastness. "O life," I cried out, and lay back as the new day dawned. Dogen wrote this. He said, "Just pick up a blade of grass and make the 16-foot-tall golden body. Pick up an atom and build a shrine for an ancient Buddha. This will be awakening the mind of enlightenment. This is seeing Buddha, is hearing Buddha, is seeing Dharma, is hearing Dharma, is being Buddha, is acting Buddha." And Thomas Cleary, who translated that, commented on these lines with, "When the ordinary is seen to be sacred, each blade of grass is the beatified Buddha. Each grain of soil is a memorial of an ancient Buddha. Then there is neither rush nor lag. Everything is as it is. Everything can be as it can be. Everything is teaching. Everything is learning. Seeing this, hearing this, being this, doing this is awakening the way-seeking mind." Hey, do you have any questions? Yeah, Holly.
Did you ever find out why they were bad men?
Well, they were bad men. by the social standards of Mexico, I mean, these really just did produce assassins. One of those men may have actually killed someone. I don't know.
But
that's not. They weren't killing me. I don't know. I mean, they were extraordinarily wonderful to me. They devoted several days. Actually, they took me on other trips too and did things. One of which was sort of like the reverse of that one. It turned out to be horrible. They got me very drunk in an Indian village on the, do you know what do they call that stuff? It's the first stage in making tequila. It's this ropey liquid that's usually flavored with fruit. And I don't know what else is in it, but I was never so sick in my life. by the way, and then when I did get back after that summer, I joined the army. It actually turned out to be just fine. It was probably exactly what I needed. But does that, I don't know. See, that story actually is loaded with clues as to what we're talking about. I mean, that was kind of a dramatic story. But it could just be sitting down on a rock somewhere and just suddenly, because of the state of mind you're in, experiencing the way-seeking mind. But there are the elements in that story are kind of typical of it. One, you drop your usual agenda. You stop being involved with what's going on in your mind. The constant paying attention to what's going on there, as if that was what was crucial in your life. Usually of being under circumstances that throw you out of your usual kilter, you know, just being, knowing who I am and what I am, and where I'm going and what I'm doing. You're in a strange place or with strange people. Often things like this are in a strange situation. Very often people have experiences of this kind around deaths, because death is also like something that we don't normally know how to deal with. So something can happen, a window can happen, can come at that point. So anyhow, ignore the exotica of that story. That's what made it fun to write and to remember, but that's not really the point. Any questions? Do you think you know what way-seeking mind is? If you do, you probably don't know. But you probably can look into your experience and then you know in a different way.